And now, a public service announcement from renowned virologist Dr. Cassandra Raley of the CDC.
The number one recommendation on how to stave this off is to wash your hands. And people, instead of just washing their hands, are like trying to buy $200 Purell online and masks. Just wash your hands. Wash your hands better, people.
Yeah.
Get your hands out of your face and in your eyeballs, you sickos.
Welcome back to Word of the Witnesses, our 12 Monkeys rewatch podcast. As always, a reminder that this is a rewatch podcast, meaning we've seen every episode and we spoil early, often, and always. Today we have an amazing treat for you guys. You're about to hear me, Beep, and Cece speaking to Emily Hampshire, Amanda Shule, Terry Metalis, and Sean Tretta. This is quite a conversation that focuses mostly on DeGlocka, but also on just some big themes of monkeys that I'm sure you guys will enjoy. So let me not delay you. Here's our interview with the cast and writers.
Thank you guys so much for making time in the middle of a pandemic to talk 12 Monkeys. This must be a kind of a weird couple weeks, especially for all of you who have told a story about a pandemic. Have you guys sort of had any big picture thoughts about that, just having told a story about this?
Well, I just literally did not just ask you, hey, what should I stock for if, like, food wise, if this happens?
But you would ask that question anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But then also, I mean, you know how you showed me the, like, we watched the webisode recently. Someone sent us this webisode that Terry did, kind of like really specifically about a virus, even though I know the show is about a virus. But anyways, I was like, it didn't even occur to me until right then when I watched it, and I was like, oh my God. This is like, I actually was worried. I'm like, can I post this? Because it's actually what's happening in the world. And I wasn't sure if that was too confronting. But Terry was like, yeah, post it.
Well, it's like Sean said, it's the press we always wish we had. I mean, we woke up this morning. Yeah, jokingly, he said. But that article that came out this morning that was on NBC.com by Dahlia Schweitzer, the first line of the article is about the show, and this thing that I wasn't aware that the head of the CDC actually said it's not about if, it's about when, which was Kathy's first line in the entire series. It's crazy.
Yeah, I ran into Richard Robbins, who is a writer on season one and two last week, and at a big meeting of our writers' union. And immediately we saw each other, and I hadn't seen him for a couple of years, and we went to shake hands. It's like, maybe not. but we literally spent, you know, a good year and a half, like, just constantly being obsessed with how, like, easy it is for these things to sort of happen and how out of control it gets. And it's a little scary.
Yeah.
I'm in Atlanta right by the CDC, so I don't know if I'm like better or worse off than everybody else.
I don't think it's better.
Yeah,
I saw that Walking Dead episode. It did not go well. was a little bit of, and maybe this was just fun, but there any thoughts about maybe doing a little webisode where Jennifer Goines, the expert at surviving an apocalypse, and Dr. Raley give some tongue-in-cheek tips?
Oh my god!
There is now.
There is a good idea. Oh my god, Terry, that's such a good idea.
Actually, it's really easy to shoot because it's just like a straight camera video diary, like YouTube mornings from Markridge.
Oh my god, but also, what if Jennifer's shopping for masks and she can't find any like I did? And then, or like, what if she's shopping for like hand sanitizer and it's nowhere, so she makes her own out of like alcohol, and then she gets real dry hands, like I've gotten real dry hands from constant washing. And that's all the things we're all really suffering with right now, dry hands. Oh, sorry.
That's fantastic.
Do I have your Markridge glasses?
Oh my God, yes I do. Yes I do. Oh my God, I have. Harry, I really actually, like, I feel like we should just end this now and go do this.
Right, that'd be good.
That's fine. We can reschedule.
We accept. Yeah.
We were just really excited you guys were coming on to talk about, well, we'll be talking about a big picture things too, but DGLOCKA. So I don't know if you had a chance to rewatch it or just thinking about how it turned out and audience reactions to it, even, you know, 2 years later after it aired. Did you guys have any idea that you sort of had this magic in a bottle as you were making it, or did it feel a little risky at the time?
Super risky. It was, this was probably the hardest one to write and to make, because everybody kind of had their own version of it in their head. And Sean and I had a very specific feeling about it that we wanted to capture. It was actually one of these things where I kind of failed as a showrunner to communicate to the room what I was going for, because I referred to it as a romp, which it still feels like a romp to me, even though it's, you know, tense. But I think tonally it was a hard needle to thread for the room. So, I was just living on set in Toronto and the room was in Los Angeles. So I would call in and, it was real tricky. And then finally it really kind of came down to the wire. And, I just got on the phone with Sean. I'm like, Sean, you just need to come up to Toronto. We just need to haul away and do this, because, and for better or for worse, who knows how it's going to turn out, but at least we have a feeling.
Like it, and that was the thing. It was like, you know, it was basically a comedy at one point, like a noises off, like, you know, it was very like almost Mel Brooksy, like we're having fun behind the scenes at a big Nazi party. And that's really not what we wanted. We got there in Toronto. We were shooting this stuff at the 12 Monkeys mansion where young Olivia meets Rayleigh, and we were upstairs, and we literally had like a weekend, I think, maybe like a week and a half or something. But it was, I remember us putting the scenes on cards and rearranging and like upstairs while downstairs they're shooting that very important, you know, mythology moment. The actual draft of this, I think we wrote in like 4 days.
Yeah. With Sean did a lot of the heavy lifting. And the famous Cassie moment was something that Sean put in the script, you know, when she comes out in Nazi lingerie and guns down. And it was one of these things I was like, I don't know if we're going to be able to pull that off, but let's keep it in the script and we'll talk about it later. And mostly because I wanted to see how Amanda felt about it, because I think, we'll get into the reaction amongst women in a moment, but we certainly didn't think it was misogynistic or whatever, but it could have been taken that way, I think. And so, but I knew it was going to work when Amanda's like, came up to me, she was like, so when do I start trying on my lingerie with the Nazi thing? I'm like, really? You're cool with this? And she's like, yeah, why not? I mean, we've never.
I had her as my screensaver on my phone for a while, her and her Nazi stuff.
We never sexualized any of the characters on the show because it just wasn't that show. You know, I've spoken about it before. Like, it never felt like a sexy show because the stakes were too high. It was like to take a moment and just kiss and screw felt like, you know, it had to be earned. So if we ever did it, it was like, you know, it wasn't going to be like Deacon and Jennifer just sneaking off for a quick one.
It was, you know, it felt like at this point we really wanted to see everybody sort of use their superpower. And then it felt like this is the one where we got to see everyone at sort of their peak, doing the peak of what we've sort of grown to love about them. And I think Cassie's thing has always been her sort of like ability to surprise everyone.
Okay, and so, I thought you were going to say our superpowers coming out in Oh, hot. Not too hot.
No, it's for Cassie to do something that was sort of shocking that we don't expect. Like, for her to really get out of that, you know, comfort zone of who she was when we first met her in the first season.
Yeah, and she's having fun. Like, the look on her face after is just so, right? I mean, we usually get to have so much fun with Jennifer, and Cassie's had everyone's had a rough go of it, but she's had a really rough go of it for four seasons. So, yeah. Now, Emily, when you either had a conversation with Terry or Sean, I read in the script that you were going to be singing Pink to Hitler. What was your reaction?
I mean, I've never been happier. I did ask, I think my second question was, well, but do I have to kill Hitler? Like, I can't remember what that was before I read it, but like, I think, weren't we talking about that, Terry? And we were talking about it, and it's like, you said, like, yeah, if you have a time machine, that's what you kind of said Jennifer's line to me, like, that that's what you do when you kill Hitler. Yeah.
I will say, this is actually our second version of killing Hitler, if you remember.
Right. Okay, so back when, remember when Jennifer did all her
Guardians.
For Guardians, yeah. She was doing all the Jennifer plays back in the 20s. The idea was how they found her was Jones was combing through history. She has the injection, so she would be able to see the time change. But go ahead, Sean.
I was just going to say, so it starts off. It's Jones and Adler and Lasky, and they're all sitting around together, and they've been up for 48 hours, and they're combing through all these historical documents looking for something, and they're falling asleep, and Jones is like, you know, go ahead, go to sleep, you know, don't worry, you know, despite my heritage, I am not Hitler, and you go to get some rest. Yeah. Well, yeah, and then Lasky and Adler are like, what? And she's like, you know, Hitler, the Fuhrer, the bastard Nazi of, and then they're like, oh, he was that guy, I think, who was like in charge before Himmler took over. And she's like, what are you talking about? And then we cut to, they pull up something on the big screen, and it's this historical footage of Hitler in the 30s at some rally or something, and all of a sudden his head explodes. And the camera pans, and we find Jennifer in the crowd pointing at the camera going like, come get me, come get me. And that's how we found out that Jennifer was stuck somewhere in the 20s.
She killed Hitler to send a message through time to Jones.
Instead, I wrote an album.
Instead, it became an album.
Both equally important things.
Yes. But that was like one of the greatest moments of my life. I feel like, well, like my personal, I don't know, checklist, bucket list of things I didn't even know I wanted in the bucket were, I got so many of those on 12 Monkeys, and definitely, I mean, singing Pink, You in Your Hand, like specifically that song, which I don't know if people know what that's about, but it's about Hitler and his hand. And just singing it to Hitler, and then, like, it was the greatest thing ever. Also, I would like to note, though, that even though that's Pink songs, those are my proprietary dance moves.
Have you had already, like, any concerns or potential lawsuits over that?
I just, like, I don't know. I think some people might be doing it in private, and even that is a violation. So
no, I agree.
I don't know.
Was there ever a debate as to whether Hitler was going to show up in this episode?
No, because I think what solidified the episode, my whole thing is they just never wanted to see his face. I never wanted to see another actor do it. It like took away from like seeing a real person. I don't know. It could tear you out of a time travel thing. Like, you know, I mean, here's the one where they cross with Thomas Edison, which you totally could have done in the show, like Jennifer and Thomas Edison, you know, but it like, what's the level at which.
Said like Jennifer meets Thomas Edison. And I'm like, that would be a really fun cartoon. Anyway, sorry. Okay. That's it. Really good educational history cartoon. Okay.
We have developed a cartoon for Jennifer. and Jones, and there is concept art and things that we just never got around to do. But I don't know. I think we'll come back to it. But the point of this this whole thing was that it the idea that there was Operation Valkyrie happening within the French resistance to take out Hitler, but it stopped our ability to save the world and get the bell. So we had to stop Operation Valkyrie and save Hitler, which is the opposite of what you do with a time machine. I think when we came into that in the room, Sean, and correct me wrong, if I'm wrong, that was the moment where like, we have to do this episode. And there was like a hot minute, like it was going to be a heist too. And we brought in John Rogers, who is a huge fan of the show, who is the showrunner on, what is it? His heist show that's coming back now.
Leverage?
Leverage, yes. And so so we did like we did a break that was like Leverage and whatnot. And then ultimately this week came with a more simple, gritty take on, you know, gone wrong.
I think what it was like originally, I think there was some sort of resistance to have the French resistance storyline because like, oh, well, it's making it too complicated. And for me, it was like, no, that's the complication you want. That's what makes these, you know, high stakes sort of things fun, is that they are so complicated, that they are so many hats on hats, and you have to improv and think quickly, and everybody's sort of working at their peak sort of, you know, ability. But I do want to go back to the you and your hand thing. Cause there was a moment where this wasn't a thing, and we were piecing this together from some, you know, previous ideas and drafts and things like that. And then it became sort of its own thing. But there was a notion at one point that Jennifer, I think, was going to do a song from The Sound of Music. And I remember sitting there and it was just like, and I just remember going, you know, it just the tone of this doesn't have energy that like we want everyone else to be like playing off of. And I said that to Terry, and Terry's like, well, you know, originally I wanted it to be this Pink song, but you know, everybody else talked me out of it. I'm like, we have to do that. Like it became like, I literally was laughing, writing some of that stuff, listening to that song. Like, this is going to be amazing.
It also transforms the whole, I mean, when you talk about the concern that you had with how Cassie's laundry scene would be taken, I think the song is crucial for that, you know, because the song is a feminist anthem. So with her dressed
she's so badass in it, because it is a feminist thing. Like, I think when people are like, oh, Cassie, and I don't think many people said this, but I think the fear was that, like, Cassie coming out in Hitler lingerie, like Nazi lingerie, was going to be misogynistic or whatever, but it was so the opposite. It was such a powerful moment for Cassie, kind of like turning it on its head.
What's interesting the most about it, and in no ways am I saying they are or were incorrect, but the women writers in the room did not like this. That it was not a feminist moment. And so I personally was sweating it out all the way through airing, because everyone I showed it to, and certainly Amanda and Emily, would always get like a preview before we aired it, and our studio and network was execs were predominantly made up of women. And so everyone was signing off, and you never truly know if like you just missed something. But I it's the thing I hear the most, I think, from female fans, that they respond to this episode. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. And the Cassie moment was really born out of the song. Like, once you were hearing that song over the scenes, like, that's what inspired that. That was never a part of the script until that, you know, song beat, and until we committed to that, then it actually seemed to write those scenes.
It was, it's been a delight that people enjoy it, specifically women.
I think one of the, this is one of those things that, you know, when you guys were writing it as opposed to when it airs, you know, that scene is in the context of an episode, you know, no offense to Cole and Deacon, but it's Jones and Jennifer and Cassie that get stuff done in this episode. And, you know, like yeah. From Jones having, you know, in Cassie's words, big balls and facing off, right, or telling off a Nazi, to obviously sort of those, the juxtaposed moments with Jennifer and Cassie. There's a real world, women are watching that in the real world, and maybe it hasn't been such a great past 2 years for women in the world. And I think that might be also one of the reasons why we're fist pumping along with it, which is one of those things, of course, you can't predict about when things are going to air. Did you have any, you have a line in the episode that Joan says that is underestimating this evil is what allowed it to take root in the first place. And that line hits hard nowadays. Is that anything you guys sort of had in mind, or is it all sort of just happy coincidence that it kind of resonates in that way?
I mean, like, you know, for us, I think when we wrote this, I mean, for one, if it feels like it's a fun episode, it's because we were having fun writing it. Like we were, you know, we were literally breaking the last few episodes of, you know, putting everything together for the entire series, and we were burnt out, we were tired, and it's stressful trying to figure out how to connect all these pieces. And this is one where it's just like, if we are just literally having the fun is just complete translating. But I think, like, you know, killing Nazis should always be a thing. And, you know, I think when we wrote it, it was, you know, it felt like we were still somewhat under that understanding that, you know, these are the bad guys. I mean, Terry and I would walk around in that set and you look up at those giant banners and it's like, you know, as kids who grew up watching Raiders of the Lost Ark and stuff like that, it's almost like, you know, and I said this to Barbara, I said, I gotta be honest with you, it almost feels like being in the Death Star right now, because it's just so arch evil that it almost becomes
cartoonish.
And yes, cartoonish.
Yeah.
And for Barbara, she was having actual anxiety seeing those banners hung up there, because she was like, you know, but you understand that from my perspective, this is, you know, this is something I lived with, and this is something that, like, is part of, you know, it's ingrained in where I'm from as being this, you know, tremendous horror. And so there was some fun in vilifying this terrible thing. And it's awful. Like, you know, in Arizona last week, somebody unfurled a Nazi banner at Bernie Sanders' rally. It's like, these are things that were supposed to be relics of the past that we could look back on as the ultimate examples of evil. And now it's muddy.
Yeah.
Right. Was the, before we move in, just the background, it's so genius. Are we understanding this correctly? The climb the steps, ring the bell is sort of a placeholder line that you guys inserted in season one. And then you figured out what it was all going to mean later.
It wasn't that placeholdery. I had, Emily, you remember the first time you.
Yeah. And I actually, I think this is coming from, I asked someone, because I always thought you knew what that was and you just didn't tell me. You were like, just say this. And I was climbing up those stairs at the
no, I knew
when I was dirty, Jennifer. Okay, that's what I thought. Who said you didn't know? Somebody said this online.
I don't know,
that
some chucklehead.
That,
yeah. I think it was Chris or something. But no, I knew enough that this goes deeper into the making of the show. So the church in which the medieval time machine stood was always something I wanted to go to. It maybe not exactly in that way, but the idea that there was some kind of temple that either existed outside of time, or which was almost the case in season four, or in deep in the future, that Cole would eventually have to go to, and that there would be these stairs and you'd have to ring this bell that would do something and blah, blah, blah. That's about as much as I knew at that moment. So I was like, just say this thing. And you did. And it's in there. So
yes.
That's about as far. as I knew at that point.
And that was at season one, where every, I remember we shot that on the stairs and you added that. Yeah. Meanwhile, the entire crew is not quite used to the show and the pace and all the story that we jam into things. And everybody was going like, oh, we're totally going to cut this scene. This scene's never going to
miss. Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, oh, I remember that, actually.
Yeah, boy, I totally remember that. Yeah, because we were like behind or something, and people, and we were just doing what, that was what just, I found so fun about it. But then, yeah, oh, God, I remember that.
I mean, you know what? It's interesting, Sean, because it's like, I think back at like how young we were, especially to like how we feel now, but
how we look,
we were,
now, yeah.
Well, and we look now too, but we were treated often as the dumb kids who somehow got a television show, and, and they were like, you don't even know that you're going to cut this. And I was like, fuck you. I'm not cutting this scene. This is going to be the whole point of the whole fourth season, motherfucker. But there was that. And like, it was frustrating. And I mean, I know Sean, and these people all, everyone, we had a wonderful team of amazing collaborators. But early on in season one, there really was a sense of these kids.
You can't do that.
What they're, yeah, these, yeah, you can't do that, well, and you don't know what you're doing. You're just kids.
I even remember, I was thinking about this the other day. I couldn't believe that you guys, you weren't the showrunner of season one. And like, cause they had, what, the Natalie Chaidez. And,
yeah.
And that's so, it's just so weird to me to say, and not like she did a great job or whatever, but like even she was, like it was your show, and it, you guys were like, you had, you knew everything about it. And so I think they didn't realize that, when they did this show, that just because you hadn't been a showrunner before, that you weren't the showrunner of this show. Like you weren't the kind of create world creator and knew everything. And now I'm making you sound like God, but you were God of the monkeys.
I am.
12 of them.
you know, Natalie was great about that. Mm-hmm. It's just like, it's your show, go run with it. And so she did let me run it, but I didn't use that authority. Like I was still, you still rely on the advice of counsel, you know, throughout heavily a lot more when, before it's like officially in your hands. And mm-hmm. I'd never done it before. So when they say to you, we can't have rain in this scene, we're not going to do it, even though you know for sure it would make it the coolest thing ever. You're like, you say we can't afford it, we can't. And then you find out you gave money back to the studio the next season. Well, then you're furious. Then you're like, all right, okay, you got me when I was young. You'll never get me again.
Yeah. And then you were like, yeah, we can have rain and...
Yeah, I mean, that was really the thing. And it's weird because, like, maybe perhaps when you look back at the timeline of 12 Monkeys, like, you know, adding the line, climb the steps, ring the bell, that it really is that time frame when everything changed, because we were making Shonen. And it was the first time I had come up to set. And, you know, I remember asking you, like, who is in charge here now? Because, you know, like, because, you know, Michael Ray, who is our producer, who, you know, season one was the no guy, and by the end of it was like, we can do anything guy, and we loved him.
You know,
there was a lot of pushback on things, and I was trying to protect what we wrote. And I remember Terry Kane, he's like, look, I think Natalie's like unofficially stepped away. So it's me now. And it's like, okay, now I have some context for things. And that's when we started to, you know, kind of fight for things, because, you know, before we were deferring for certain things, and then I think that's when it like became 12 Monkeys. Like, you know, all right, now the crazy people are in charge.
The crazy people are in charge. And, you know, it specifically speak for Emily, there was a quality in Emily that I wanted for Jennifer that
nobody liked.
Nobody quite understood. Well, I think in the beginning, no one understood. And so, you know, I think that in the first time you play Jennifer, I mean, I remember almost like that first day,
a lot of
by heart. I can tell you the whole day when what?
Me too.
And the director was like, you know, just say the line. And there I was going,
and walk well, from here to there.
Yeah. And I was like, no, no, that, but that's not, that's what's not going to, that's not what's going to make this work. She needs to be able to breathe and improvise and be Emily Hampshire. And so, I made sure I was always on set for a Jennifer scene because, and just speaking of the crazy ones in charge, I'd be like, okay, now let her do whatever she wants. Now just like,
nope.
she'd ad lib a line and be like, oh my God, that's the greatest line ever. Keep, you know, go even farther.
I will never forget that first day because, so that first day was also my entire second episode, which was Jennifer's kind of introduction into the show. And, well, like her first, you know, the mental hospital and everything. And it was everything in that episode was my first day. And I also wasn't used to doing a TV show. Like I was used to doing like indie movies where people would like, you'd go onto set and like, you'd do what you kind of felt like in a certain way. And then you talk about it and stuff. But this was like, and this is no fault of our director. He definitely was like, okay, so you start here and then like, just say the lines. And I, oh my God, I was crying a lot and tear. And it definitely, I remember from that day, it was like that you were always there. And because you had told me something in my audition, I remember you were like, well, the screen does something. You're like, I promise I'll always let you at least have one where you can like do whatever. And cause I don't know, I think we both felt that was important. And then when you did let me improvise, it was always kind of from an uneducated place, like the unicorn. Carrie would always let the camera keep rolling. And when I was naming extinct animals, I was like, next we're going to save the unicorn. And then I kept going. And then after I heard this laughing, and like, Carrie's like, you know that the unicorn isn't an extinct animal, right? and that's the day I learned that unicorns, some people think they never existed.
By the way, that outtake is actually on the Blu-rays. And then you go, fucking Terry, right on stage in front of him.
Do you guys know offhand what some of the ad-libbed lines were that made it into the show?
Oh, God, there's so many. I don't know.
A Jennifer moment.
So these are my best friends. They're like my best friends.
Yeah.
I told you to say that. That wasn't an ad-lib. An ad-lib line from Jennifer would be...
I think that's all of them.
I remember that differently. But yeah, okay, sorry, go.
Usually when you're like manic, the Emerson Hotel bit. When you're at the hotel. That's all Emily checking into a hotel.
You're picking your pocket.
May I please speak to the manager? I really just want to speak to the manager, please. What was it? There's like a whole scene.
You break it, you buy it.
Oh, yeah. You break it, you buy it. That whole thing.
But your additions were like something. Oh, it was, I don't know. Did this end up in the thing? Because I was so offended. You were like double wrapped, something about a condom.
Oh, no,
the dude,
that's in there. The guy said that. He's like,
I was so offended. Ooh, gross. Ugh, I can't. Ugh. Okay.
It was the kind of hotel you bring a hooker to.
Oh,
so,
okay.
That's why you double bag it. I don't know whose line that was. I've never heard that before. Someone else came up with that.
As long as we're talking about PSAs, about viruses and stuff, that's actually not helpful. So don't do that. I mean, just as we're talking about Jennifer, I mean, this is such a fun stretch of episodes because we just get to have so much fun. But Jennifer doesn't have her powers in these episodes. And so one of the things I love kind of going back and rewatching Diglaca in particular, and of course we're like singing along and having so much fun with her, it's also like a big confidence moment for her,
You know, like, this isn't about her powers. This isn't being able that she sees through time or interpreting images. This is just the woman we started this journey with, who had a lot of self-doubt, has been sort of on this journey of believing in herself and stepping on this stage and basically giving Hitler the finger. Do you guys have any thoughts sort of just about where, I don't know, like Jennifer's journey overall, and maybe about where this part, because this is just really about her and her belief in herself, if that makes sense.
I love that.
I was just gonna say, like, she's definitely the most courageous character, because she does believe in herself, but kind of not really. She's operating with so much doubt, yet it's, you know, wanting to help her friends and wanting to, you know, that's what pushes her through. It's just she reaches down into this well of courage that, you know, and that's what I noticed most in the rewatch, is that, wow, she's like the real, not just the things she does, but just how she emotionally gets herself to places where she can do this stuff is really the most, I think, impressive thing about it. And it's not that she's not afraid. It's just she's doing it despite being afraid.
Yes. And I think it's because she's always doing it for, like you said, for her friends and for someone like other than her. And I think in, like, I don't know, I feel this way, that when I find it very hard to stand up for myself, but if somebody, like, I can defend my friend to the end. Like, so, and I feel like Jennifer is very that her bravery and courage just come from a place where it's for Cole or for her friend Cassie. Like, she is that hero in a way that she doesn't even, very reluctant hero, but like, it's because it's not for her that she can do it.
But it's cool too, though, that she trusts them so much, you know, like in the moment when she falls back off the subway platform, because she's just like, I mean, I guess Cole's going to be there. There's such a spontaneity about Jennifer where, even though she has the self-doubt, it's almost like she considers that afterward. Like, we just have to do this and then we'll sort it all out later.
Yeah, I miss Jennifer.
We all do.
Yeah.
I mean, what you all were just talking about actually reminds me of the John Donne poem that Jones quotes from at the end. You know, no man is an island. And I mean, I think in some ways, you know, our good guys win because they're doing it for each other as much as they're doing it for this, you know, for the world, all of that. It's really, they're willing to put themselves on the line for each other. And, you know, what Ethan said to Olivia, you're going to lose because you're alone. If you guys have any sort of thoughts about that, because the John Donne poem that Jones reads from at the end, it's really beautiful, but it just seems to tie into sort of a larger theme of the show.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned that, because, you know, Chris Monfette is on the show that I'm running now, Star Trek Picard season 2. And he suggested that poem for something. We were like, what could Picard quote? And, you know, anything Patrick Stewart says. And then, and I was like, wait a minute, I feel like we've used this before. And then I was realizing, ripping off ourselves.
it does fit perfectly, though.
This episode was really the last time we could, like, the gang could be together, love each other, and have fun before it gets really bad. Because by the next episode on, it's not particularly fun, even though we go to the medieval times and there's a couple of jokes here and there, specifically with Jennifer. It gets really dark before it gets any better. So that poem being about the family, and that's, you know, and then Stephen Barton's music, that theme he wrote for the 12 Monkeys family comes up. It is, I think, where the show is at its best, I think, is that group. At the end, listening to Barbara read that poem, I mean, there's really nothing better. I probably won't do anything better than that.
Well, because you know how I don't really still, after 4 seasons of time travel and stuff like that, is very difficult for me to wrap my head around. But what I think resonates so much for everyone is that thing of family. Like, and it doesn't mean family that's like your blood family. It's like any kind of the family that is there for you. And that's like your chosen family or your friend family or whatever. But like, I think that's in the end what it became.
Yeah.
This episode, I just wanted to ask really quickly just about the filming of it. I mean, from the opening scene where everybody is lined up in front of that, it looks like a chateau. It looks like a film. It is just
the production value.
Yeah. The costumes, the cinematography. I mean, it just, if you think back, going back to season one, as much as I love season one, like this is just a beautiful episode of TV. So do you all have any stories about what it was like to film in this big house and dressed up in these amazing costumes? Cause even the French maid costume is awesome.
I do have a very vivid recollection of walking into that room with, and it does hurt, but with those, the like Nazi symbols, those big flags that came down. And it was just like being on set and seeing all the extras and everyone dressed in these, like you really felt like you were back in time and because we were in Prague and like, it takes you there. And it was so, I've never been on something that looked so expensive and wasn't.
Right. I mean, we scattered that in Prague, and it's really hard to find a place that one had, you know, architecture that could be considered sort of French, that had a big enough ballroom, that had back hallways with side rooms, that had a basement, and then interesting grounds outside. It was tough to find. We looked at about 7 of them. And a lot of them had like, oh my God, it's an amazing ballroom, but it didn't have back hallways and it didn't have a basement, and some places had great basement and great hallways and then a tiny. So it was just, you know, we were very lucky to find this place. It's not on screen, but in one of the rooms, it's a giant alligator, like a stuffed alligator. Just randomly.
Why would that not be on screen? That's crazy.
Yeah.
What a waste.
There's enough stuff crammed into this episode, but yeah, in another world, perhaps that alligator is someplace.
Do you have one of those at your place, Emily?
If I'd known about that alligator, I don't know why no one told me about that, because they knew I would take that home with me.
Thinking it was like on set and just taking it.
It was like feet long. It's huge. There's a couple, I mean, it was pretty crazy. Like if you took an Instagram photo of, you know, any of our Nazi extras and just put on a black and white filter, it looked legitimately like a vintage pic. But, you know, one of the other tidbits that I don't know if people know is that what's the name of the character, Sean? Barbara's son is
Han
in this episode. Barbara's son plays the French resistance man.
Oh, awesome.
Victor. Right? Victor? No, not Victor. Victor?
No. What's his name? I just looked it up. It's weird because I didn't remember his name, and I just realized, no, his name is Hans in real life,
Hans,
too.
His name, yeah. His name is Hans.
Yeah. Oh, right. The character's name was Hans, and his name was Hans.
I just pulled up the IMDb, Terry, and I just realized he was in a movie with my wife a few years ago, and he played Hans.
That's weird.
So there's a theme there.
Not really, though.
There's a theme.
It's the extended 12 Monkeys verse.
Those are the
Forever Hans.
Forever Hans. It's lovely to have Barbara and her son there.
Hey, just to go off on like kind of a rabbit hole for a minute, this is something that I've always asked and I know other people have brought up too. So Deacon comes out, right? He's kind of the one that saves the day as far as with the detonator. And he comes out and immediately hands it to Jennifer. Was that always the plan? Or like, even if it was or wasn't, it doesn't matter. That's what you did. Was there like a deeper meaning to that? Because their relationship has just always been like so, so core and so central to both of their development, really.
Well, they're both the outsider crazy ones. And I think
he killed me.
And he killed.
I mean,
it,
only but once.
But he's also.
But he feels bad about it.
But when Jennifer says, wait a minute, we're going to save Hitler, that's the opposite of what you do with a time machine. I think he's there for that, right? So he hears her say that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, yeah. I'm going to give this to my girl. And no, not a romantic girl. But like, this is his sister. He loves her, you know? And then so he gives it. And I mean, just from a storytelling point of view, you want Jennifer Goins to be the one who actually kills Hitler. Like, if you're not doing that, then what have you done, really? She's not going to
overcomplicate it with a bunch of reasoning and going down the wormhole, which is like, nope, this is what you do.
Exactly.
But Beep and Tina, do you want to talk to Emily about the Deacon Jennifer relationship and get this off your chest?
Well, I mean, I know what you're getting at, Terry.
They ship them.
No. Oh, I know. I don't.
No, we are just
we have
open.
Friends.
We are open to different people's passions. We would love to. I mean, it is something, particularly as you go back and rewatch it. It really is a wonderful friendship that you, as Beep said, you can sort of trace. It's integral. It seems integral to both of their character development, and you don't see a lot of those friendships on TV. And I don't know how rare it is to be playing part of that. But if you did have any thoughts, sort of about the friendship between Deacon and Jennifer, I think it is something people would love to hear about.
Well, I think it does really spring from two places. Like one that he tells her, but also a relationship that kind of goes, I guess, in reverse in a way from his mind, is that like he knew her when she was older. So it's kind of like, you know, when you know somebody from when they were a baby, it's like the opposite of the same. Yeah. But I can tell you the only romantic, because a lot of people have always said, like, tried to figure out what Jennifer, like who Jennifer would be with or something. Like you said before, Terry, that like you never, like people having sex and stuff in the apocalypse was weird. The only romantic relationship Jennifer ever would have is old Jennifer and Terry. Terry is secretly, and I'm giving out the secret.
The turtle?
Terry is legitimately, no, you are in love with old Jennifer.
Oh, yeah.
You have said that's who you want to marry. You are madly in love with old Jennifer.
Old Jennifer, there is a wisdom to old Jennifer. I loved writing for old Jennifer's my favorite character probably.
Yeah.
She could have her own show because she's past like all the craziness. You know what I mean? She's good because she's literally seen death and
she gives no
time
fuck.
Paradoxes. What'd you say?
I said she gives no fuck. That's
exactly what I was going to
say. You know, and it's come around, you know, to self-acceptance in a way that some human beings never do. You know, her saying I love you to herself. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, I'll probably never say that to me. Old Jennifer is she's just adorable. You just want to like pinch those big cheeks of hers. Those big prosthetic cheeks.
Now, I think I read somewhere, and Emily, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that you approach Tatiana Maslany about playing multiple characters. Is that right?
Oh, I did ask her when we were going to do the first time I was doing old Jennifer, Hello Egg, I'm Chicken, which is, here's a bit of trivia. Hello Egg is my production company, which I got from old Jennifer. But yeah, no, I asked her because I'd never done that before. And it was like, any kind of tips, tricks, and she did give me a lot of help. And also what was even more help than any of that was that I worked with Catherine, the girl who played Tatiana's double on Orphan Black, came and played my double for all the scenes that I did with myself. So that was a huge, huge help.
Oh, that's awesome, because she has obviously a lot of experience with that. And I know that Tatiana always praised her and kind of, you know, said like, the reason that I'm as good as I am, like, has so much to do with her, and she doesn't get enough credit.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine, though, that she does that job? She does all the things that Tatiana does, all of them, but is not seen.
Yeah, like, not on screen.
Yes, yeah.
Emily, before you guys have to all head out, Jennifer, I mean, obviously the big concert in this episode, but also the season three opener of 99 Red Balloons, or sort of the Mary Tyler Moore walking through the city, you know, with the umbrella montage. Do you have sort of any favorite moments of where you just were like, this is so fun that this is my job?
Oh, my God. I mean, I say this all the time that, like, there is, and Todd and I were talking about this too, and he did kind of a live Facebook live thing, that, like, what other, like, for all of us, not just me, but, like, what other show do you get to play as an actor, play every time period, and play, like, play yourself older, younger, act with yourself, like, unless you're in theater, you don't get to do this stuff. And so the opportunity of this show, not just to do it, but to do it at the top of the game, like, to get to do, like you're saying, the this episode in this time period, like, it to me never looked better on TV. And so that, I mean, this is just a general answer to the question, is like, it's all I every day, and Terry can attest to this, I send him a Bitmoji every day of being like, I miss Jennifer, and like sad Bitmoji face. And but I guess my favorite, I feel like 99 List Balloons was a departure moment, because I remember, Terry, the thing you set up for that. It was like this, it was like we entered into Jennifer's head in such a new way, that we'd always kind of enter into her head through movies and TV quotes. And like I always felt Jennifer was always like playing a role. And this was finally Jennifer. And maybe this had something to do with, in me, I always like to be in a musical. And I think when, Jennifer is under pressure, she will go there. And I feel like the way it was shot and the way it looked, like, everybody who I show that to or who sees that is like, holy shit, just can't get over the look of it too, and how like amazing it looks. And we shot it in, like, you put up some walls and some confetti, and it was like, when you find out what the no budget we had for that and what Terry kind of did, anyways, that was, I guess, one, but there's so many, I'm gonna cry. So
no. I need to tell you before you have to go, like, just as from person to person, because we haven't gotten the opportunity to state, you're not a person.
Okay. From animal to animal.
Okay, mm-hmm. Perfect. From unicorn to unicorn.
Yeah.
Jennifer is my favorite character, for sure. I have so much appreciation for just like what she embodies. And even though in the mythology of the show and canonically, it ends up that she's not ill, she's not crazy, she's not any of that, there's still so many elements of mental illness that are presented. And as someone who's bipolar, I just want to tell you, like, that's so meaningful. It's amazing what you did with it. And I know that, you know, part of that goes to the writers. There's so much in so many people involved in that, but like, you just did amazing with it. And it's, it was very impactful.
Thank you. But, you know, that just reminds me that I didn't tell you this yet, Terry, but so I was just recently with my acting coach who helped me with 12 Monkeys and everything. And we were talking about this project I was doing. And she's like, you know, I believe that projects come into your life for a reason. And I was saying that, yeah, like, I agreed with her. And then she said, you know, like, and Jennifer and 12 Monkeys, like, when that came into your life and how that changed, and she started crying, Terry, she started crying at like how much that was, how important that role was for me in my life. And it was in the same way that like you're talking about, I think for mental health stuff and just for like being a person, like I said, I wasn't a person, yeah. But I feel like Jennifer can just, that kind of realization that that you always had it in you in your own back, like that kind of Wizard of Oz thing. Like you always knew, even though everybody else was like saying you were crazy. I do think crazy, I really believed that from the beginning, that crazy is kind of, it's a specialness, a sixth sense that you know something. You know something more. Anyways, Kate, I love Jennifer.
No, it makes sense. I mean, but I would also look, I mean, it's also validation, I think, for the brand of Emily Hampshire, because I've seen you on Schitt's Creek. I've seen you do musical numbers on Schitt's Creek, but there's still something about Jennifer that feels like it's just a lot of Emily, you know? And
is true. When people meet me and know me from Schitt's Creek and have seen 12 Monkeys too, like anybody I know says this, they're like, oh, you're really not like Vivian. You're really like Jennifer. Like Jennifer is definitely, yeah, sorry.
Right. So, but I think that's probably like, I mean, how amazing is it that the response to you is, I mean, uniformly, like the fans love it, you know? And I think it also gave us a voice, you know, for Sean and us to be like, okay, we know she can do this kind of joke. So, and we know she can do this. So let's go even farther. Like, you know, Sean doing the Jennifer play, like that could easily have not worked.
Yeah.
Like
the only person in the world who could do this stuff.
Right. Like we could have easily bombed out. And I was always like, oh, we didn't go too far this time. But, I mean, I don't know. You guys should probably talk about that because I still think that's one of the great, I know we're past that episode, but that is one of the great Emily showcases.
I always wondered though, every season I remember I would say this to him, like, cause I'd be like after, the Markridge thing on the desk, walking on the desk, I'm like, where, how can it get better than that? Then 99 Loose Balloons, I was like, well, now we've like, how can anything be better than that? And like every time you'd pull through and like not only pull through, but it like always kind of popped itself in a way that I never thought it could. But it definitely, yeah, Jennifer, it is weird though when you say like Jennifer is someone that I think people always kind of expect me to be like Stevie because she's much more cool normal. But yeah, I feel like I got to express myself in a way that I feel like I'm a lot of the time too much in life. And like, I think Jennifer kind of gets that too. And so I could at least be that way as Jennifer and blame it on her. But that's really me.
Well, Stevie's my favorite too. So
I love Stevie. I feel so lucky. Like, can you imagine though, again, as an actor that I got to do both these things at the same time, like, and it's funny now doing interviews where people regularly ask me like, oh, do you like doing comedy or drama better? And I'm like, you know, I feel like I had some of the most comedic moments I've ever had in 12 Monkeys, which was like a show you wouldn't call a comedy, and some of the most serious things in Schitt's Creek. So to me, that's like, it's, I love both of them. Yeah. I feel like I always say this too, like Stevie feels like a vacation from myself. That's why mm-hmm. I feel like I get to sit behind the desk and play Sudoku and watch people. And Jennifer feels like I can let that monkey out of the cage for a minute. And
yeah. You guys got to ask her about the end of the show, which her point of view on the end of the show. By the way, I say that not knowing the answer.
Wait, what's my point of view? What is it? On the end of the show.
Well, they ask a thing of all their guests, which is, what do you
think? Oh, yeah. Red Forest or no?
Oh, I used to think, I mean, I thought, I don't know what I thought. What did I think? I used to think something. I think I used to think, no? I can't. Oh, okay. I have to decide, though. I'm not good with decisions. You got to cut decisions. You know, the word decision, the root of it comes from decision is slicing something in half. So you have to, it's just like you cut it in half. and then you have to only take one. I would like to take, cut it in half and take both, like save one for later, like eat one now, save it for later. Nope. I don't know.
It's kind of, I mean, it's a perfect Emily answer. For
yeah. That. You mean you want to have both things at once?
Oh, shut up.
No, I could have one
Sean, trying to get the Red Forest out of you. My watch.
You know, there is a great moment. You know, we basically had an existential crisis talking about the last episode that Christopher Lloyd was in after. There was a great exchange between Deacon and Jones in this episode where they both, it's almost an answer to the last episode in some ways, or I think you could take it as such, when they're at the bar before they join the group. And they basically embrace that they are both coming to an end and find that empowering and find freedom in that. Mm-hmm. And rewatching it, I thought that what a great bookend in some ways, or a response to the way we ended the last episode, right? With Shaw kind of pushing Cassie to a point where she's like, yeah, actually, that does sound good. And I never caught that sort of rewatching it. I don't know if you guys had
such
sort
a good
of
show to rewatch.
Yeah, there's so much is hidden along the way. You guys did a great job. I mean, there's stuff in like 301 that's in 310, or you know, 301 that's in 409, and just it's crazy that certain lines that seem like they're throwaway come to mean so much later on.
Ring the bell. I actually think that Climb the Steps, Ring the Bell, the main thing aside from like the whole kind of crux of the show was that there is a time when we have to climb steps in Prague, and there were so many steps, and it was hot, and there were so many steps, and I think Terry just wanted me to climb all these steps over and over again.
Yeah.
So that was the whole point of that.
We want to hear sort of what you all are working on right now or next, but we had one really quick mythology question for Sean and Terry that had come up that folks wanted us to ask. And I don't know if you had a chance to, we were going around and around. One of the things when you go back and rewatch the show in the last episode, when Cassie asks, you know, what happens after, and you showed us actual footage of the quote unquote after of this story. What's the sort of canon, if there is one explanation for why Cole saw sort of it's because he's the djinn?
He's the center of it all. And always has been. So, yeah. No, I listened to your last podcast, and I have thoughts.
Uh-oh. Are those thoughts you want to share now or off?
Well, it was interesting. One of the comments, Sean, which it was a very pro Red Forest ending from Selena. Is that who
yeah,
was on, right, with Selena? And
shocking.
Yeah, no, you should hear the mental gymnastics she goes through to try and make it rationalize it's the Red Forest. Like it's almost Trumpian in a way, how people like want the Red Forest. They'll be like, well, you know, the red forest wants you to believe. The Red Forest
make the Red Forest red again. So,
guys, those hats are red. God, I didn't think about that.
Oh, God.
I also have, and I'm hoping this is going to work, I have one more surprise for you all today that
somebody else just came in.
Yeah, this is my other surprise. Say hi, surprise.
Oh, hi,
surprise.
I'm just calling. Hi, surprise to you. I'm just calling to find out how much everyone really enjoyed working with Amanda Shule on the show.
Amanda Shule. I'm Amanda Shule, and I can do. Hi.
So, on a scale of 1 to 10, is that? I just need an answer. The people are demanding answers, and I need to give them what they want.
I mean, like a 6.5, like above average.
Well, wait, what season?
cumulatively.
Did you hear the part? I guess you weren't on listening when there was a part where we were talking about you and your Nazi
No, now she can talk about it.
No, I missed
okay,
that.
Okay, but I just, well, what I did, do you remember when I had that as my screensaver on my phone for a while?
I do remember
your
that.
Your wardrobe picture for that. So,
yeah, that was my, what?
Had that dream, Emily, remember? It was like the most beautiful.
Oh, my God, no! No! No.
Also,
no. We'll leave that as an inside joke. Okay, so.
But yeah. My takeaway from that dream, though, Emily, was that you went into your trailer and had an uninterrupted 5-hour nap. That's how long I sleep at night. Who takes a 5-hour nap?
Yeah, that's me. You have a lot. I feel like somebody needs to make a coffee table book of every show I've ever been on. I can just sleep anywhere. It's a talent. I can sleep anywhere. I actually recently. I fell asleep in an interview that was online, and the way they cut it, they tried to cut it out, but my head kept nodding, and people think I'm on drugs, but I'm not. I'm just napping. So there is where I get it. Yeah.
That's probably the closest to old Jennifer you get is your ability to just lie down anywhere,
to nod off, yeah,
and just sleep, but not just sleep like snore. Like,
no, false.
Yes. Do you remember the time in Prague when you fell asleep and you woke up and you were we had turned you into like a buffet table? We put all that food on you.
Oh yes. Yes, I also remember the time when you put by the craft truck, you blew up a childhood picture of mine where I stole candy at Halloween from this other kid who's crying behind me, and you blew it up and you said, "Don't let this girl near the craft table."
Yeah.
Oh gosh. Amanda. Okay. Amanda.
Back to me. I called in, guys. Back to me.
Amanda. Let's talk about the butt shot. Let's talk about your snotty lingerie.
Yeah, but I think that the compromise was that Emily cropped my head out of it, so you couldn't totally tell. Well, maybe you didn't. Maybe you could.
You told me I had to. At first I did, and then you told me I had to, so I just zoomed in. And then also, Amanda, here's a bit of BTS. Is Amanda and I maintain a healthy relationship on Instagram by sending each other gross medical pictures, and then we have to find a pun about them.
Healthy relationship. Yeah.
Healthy relationship.
I know. If anyone got a hold of my phone and the content that I follow on Instagram, I'd probably
think you were a serial killer.
Yeah, no, I definitely have people show up at my door to ask some questions. But in particular, it would be the seriously important content that you and I swap back and forth. Ugh.
Yes.
Amanda, what was your reaction in the script when you read that you would be coming out in lingerie and a Nazi cap?
Well, you know what's funny is that I remember you and Sean wrote that episode, and which is probably why Sean's on the phone. Hi, Sean. And
with Sarah Mueller, another writer as well. Her first was our writer's assistant as well.
And
Hi.
All. I didn't even say hi. I just kind of bombarded into the conversation. And I read it and I didn't think anything of it. I just thought like, oh yeah, that makes total sense. And then you came up to me, Terry, and you said, so what do you think about that? Will you do it? And then
that's how I said it. So creepy.
That's when I was like, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Maybe Terry knows something that I don't know. Does he have like a vision that I wasn't in? Then I started to get concerned about what you had up your imagination sleeve. And
I'm so glad you said imagination.
Yeah.
But no, when I first read it, I was like, oh yeah, cool. Diversion tactic makes total sense. It didn't faze me. And then when you said something about it, I thought maybe it should be fazing me. And then when we started to get into wardrobe consultations, it really started fazing me. And then when we got to Prague and I realized that the only thing I could eat were potatoes and Danishes, then it really started to concern me because I
needed to. And then you saw my phone.
Well, I started.
Everybody was drinking in Prague too, which is bloats you, and you can't do that.
Yeah, yeah. but the, I don't eat meat, and they're not a big vegetarian country. And we were staying at that hotel the second time around in Prague. We were staying at that hotel that had that bakery built in, and they made pastries right in front of your face every day. And and also the catering in Prague was delicious. So that was disappointing. I think I probably could have been a little bit more toned up than I was, but yeah, that's when I started to get
murdered.
Yeah.
Just one of those things when the day came, I was like, oh, right, this. Yikes. And I started doing squats like that afternoon, like that was going to do anything for me. So that's how I felt.
I purposely ate as Jennifer to, because I felt her character would be just.
You're so method.
Yeah, actually, that's true. Whenever I had to eat snacks, I'd eat them in between takes, and you'd be like, Emily, no.
No, the no, Emily, was every time I tried to take a picture of you, and you'd give me this sort of like doe-eyed, very sweet, loving look, but it just didn't translate well on film.
It did. Oh my God. Hey, Amanda, since we have you here, do you want to do some webisodes about coronavirus?
No. Are you?
Hearts breaking everywhere. We need to hear from Dr. Raley about how we're supposed to, what are we supposed to do in a pandemic?
Should I take over the position of the health czar? No.
You mean you don't want to be the face of this?
It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
I know. I was telling Terry that I see that little slogan everywhere, and I guess, obviously, we're not the first to have coined that, but it just reminds me of that very first day in Detroit. Whenever I hear that, sadly, that reminds me of, it is a little too close to home, isn't it, guys?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's disturbing.
I'm also really missing Dr. Raley's extreme competence leadership.
Oh, we could definitely use some of that and maybe a little less bullshit and lies right now. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Also, people should just start washing their hands. Like, how about that?
That's a new thing in 2020.
We just did episode one right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's what I don't understand. So maybe I am like jumping into the coronavirus webisode situation. But like the number one recommendation on how to stave this off is to wash your hands. And people, instead of just washing their hands, are like, trying to buy $200 Purell online and masks. Just wash your hands. Wash your hands better, people.
Yeah.
Get your hands out of your face and in your eyeballs, you stickos.
Wow. That is pure Amanda Scholl right there, guys. Wash your hands. Wash your hands. One of the questions from the last episode that they did a podcast on was the butt stuff, only. reaction, and they asked,
yeah.
I don't think so. I think you knew it was coming, right? They said, was that Amanda Scholl's honest reaction? Yes, no, it is your honest reaction.
It is my honest reaction, but no. That was written.
It was in the script.
Yeah, I wrote that in.
It was in the script because you thought it was the funniest thing that you had ever written in your entire career.
And it was. It really is.
Yeah, guys and poop jokes and butt jokes.
High bar, 12 Monkeys. No, but I also remember
definitely
that.
Definitely not a poop joke. Let me be clear about this. I don't know.
Yeah, I have a delayed, resented reaction to that.
You mean?
The poop joke. No, because Terry, I also remember that because we were discussing various choreography for that scene. And
oh, yeah. So it could... Basically, what she's saying is it couldn't be from behind. or else it was too close to home.
Then
it wouldn't be a joke.
No, so that was the concern.
That would have been a little too on the ass at that point.
No. I don't think Cassie knows that position. So
yeah, that's
Cassie in your mind is such a prude, but okay.
Let's not go there because I recall a certain conversation we all had with Aaron Stanford in which you specified
Oh, how often? On birthdays, special occasions.
A specific act would occur involving the mouth.
Oh my God.
Thanks so much for saying that out. Yeah, exactly. Literally. But no, that was because we were discussing, like, you know, also, like, people don't shower a lot in the apocalypse. You know, it's like, No, you need to take all the factors into consideration. Hygiene, wash your hands and your stuff, you know?
I feel like we all need to wash our hands right now.
Because of this conversation.
I need to wash my mind's eye.
I washed my hands of this conversation. Yeah.
Sorry, everyone. I just called into class up the phone conversation.
This is honestly the best. Like, having both of you guys on when the you and your hand scene is pretty much our, like, one of our favorite feminist, like, heck yeah.
Women's Day, Emily.
It is, yeah.
Oh my God, yeah. That's such a good idea to couple it with, hey Amanda, happy Women's Day.
Hey, Emily, happy Women's Day to you.
Thanks so much. Yeah.
Since you're both on this day, do you guys have any thoughts sort of about, I know different people have come on and talked about this, but just, we just posted on our Twitter account all of the amazing female characters from this show just to celebrate International Women's Day. I feel like we're still waiting for a show that matches not only the number of really important female characters, but just the depth and how different they all were. Either of you have any thoughts just not only about your characters, but playing off of all of the other really interesting women that were part of the story?
I agree with that. I can't think of anyone on 12 Monkeys, any female character who wasn't strong and somebody I wouldn't find beautiful qualities that I would love to have. Even down to The Witness, down to Allison's, you know, many iterations of her character throughout every single season had such poise and strength in certain situations, whether you loved her or hated her. Every single character on the show was created, created by men and embodied by women in such a bold, strong way that I've never seen on another show.
And I think especially now what I find interesting is that was kind of, Terry created these women at a time when, like, no one was telling you you had to create a certain amount of women. Like, you actually just, because of the woman in you, you just had to made all these amazing female characters because that's what you just naturally do, which I find so interesting.
I appreciate that. I mean, but it's Sean, it's Chris, it's Kristen, it's Oliver, Travis, from at the very beginning, he's the one who wrote that line, the first monologue, Cassie's first monologue. So it's definitely a group, but I know what's weird is, and Sean, and I think I've said this before, but like we didn't set out to do it. It was just organic to the characters we wanted to write. We were never like, what if it's a strong female villain or this is a strong, it was just like, just write it good.
Jennifer, you did say, I think, to make it not as, because that was a character that was already in the thing. So to make that not Jeffrey Goins, like just make it a woman. I don't know. I have no point.
That was a conscious decision.
We never once had a conversation about like, let's lean into like a certain representation. We just, these were real people to us. And especially after season one, when they became real people, when we saw the performances, it was just, what would they do? So it was never like everything in Zyglocka is just, what would these characters do? Not what do we want them to do? It's four seasons of them eventually starting to write themselves, to where it's like, of course we do the J.H. Bond thing because that's Jennifer. And, of course Rayleigh's at a point where she's going to do something out of the box for her. Like, it just became part of them. Like, it was never us trying to, puppeteer anything. It's just, that's who they became.
I think also that you have to take into consideration the fact that you all did a hell of a job with casting. Every single person that came onto that show, I was impressed and excited by, you know, male or female, but in particular, the women that you found, because we didn't necessarily have big names come on the show. We were fortunate enough to have a handful of names, but you found some people who were just so perfectly suited and so perfectly interesting, who worked in our world, not just with your words and with the material, but also with, you know, the dysfunctional monkey family that we had created. You know, we're still friends, all of us, after the show, which speaks volumes of how you were able to find people that just melded so seamlessly, you know, with their character and with our little gang.
I miss that gang.
It was a good gang.
Since we have you both on, one, if we sort of think back, one of the sort of unexpected pleasures, especially when you go back and rewatch the show, is the, at least when it started out, can we say unlikely friendship between Cassie and Jennifer? starting out with, who's this bitch? you know, and going through sort of Bodies of Water and season 2.
Bodies of Water, yeah.
Yeah. And then going all the way, you know, we're headed toward what I thought one of the most poignant scenes at the end of season 4 is when, you know, Jennifer's ripped up her hands and Cassie is binding them up and they're both grieving Deacon. And you sort of realize how far this friendship has come. And we'd love to hear both of your thoughts about their friendship.
Emily, would you like to start?
Well, the only reason I'd like to start is I feel like I don't want to go after something that makes sense and is smart and everything like that. So, I do think 12 Monkeys was actually the first show or thing that I worked on that, I felt that not only in the character, like in the writing with our relationship, but like pretend you're not here. I felt that with Amanda on set, like as, a female on set who I felt that was Barbara too, that we were all like supportive of each other. And usually I think a lot of the time women on set are kind of like thought of and cast as like cat fighting. And so, and there was never any of that. And so to have episodes actually where our characters would like grow to care about each other in the way that I did about Amanda. Amanda didn't about me, but I really loved Amanda. So that felt really good. Now go ahead, Amanda. You answer.
Ditto. But also, I think that I specifically remember a couple of days on, I think it was Bodies of Water, and then there was another day where you and I were sitting in a car. It was just starting to get cold. Oh. Pierre was complaining about how cold it was. and I'm trying to remember which scene. We were waiting for somebody to come out. We were sitting in the car and we were waiting for somebody to come out of something, out of some sort of a warehouse. That was the scene.
Oh, I totally remember this. The car. We were waiting for the car to come out with Deacon and everybody. Mm-hmm. It was freezing. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I remember being really struck by how comfortable I was being uncomfortable with you. You know, which I think is really, no, but I mean that actually like in a delicate way, like not like in like a goofy, awkward way. I mean, like, you know, part of being an actor is being vulnerable. And if you feel really guarded with your acting partner in a scene, it's really hard to just wear your heart on your sleeve and not force it. Not force an emotion, not play at it, not pretend like you're feeling sad or angry or whatever it is. And I remember feeling so comfortable being vulnerable with you, and that I hope I allowed you that same space, because the two of us and our two characters had so many opportunities for them to show what was underneath all the layers. And that was why Cassie grew to care about Jennifer, because she realized that she was broken and that she wasn't maniacal and that she wasn't doing what she was doing for these, you know, vindictive or horrible reasons. She was doing it because she was broken. And And so to be able for you to have your best performance, I needed to show up for you and you needed to show up for me. And that's just, I remember thinking that that was a really lovely opportunity that I had to work with you.
Mm. Guys, do you want to do a reboot? That's big now. People love doing reboots now.
Terry, didn't you have an idea that you said was, are you allowed to say or willing to say you had an idea for a continuation of the story that was percolating?
Yes, I do. I mean, it'll never happen, but yeah, there is a way to.
Good old optimistic Terry.
Yeah.
Do another. There is a way to do another series. Where they try to escape the Red Forest. Yeah. Right. Okay. I can tell you who won't be on staff. But I think, you know, it's interesting. I wouldn't do it because I do think 12 Monkeys is the perfect ending. So it is still the end of that story. And this is the beginning of a different one, but with these characters. So it wouldn't step on.
You don't want to pay it a disservice.
Yeah, it's not like the witness is back and they've got to get back in action. Right. No, it's a whole different thing.
No, people wouldn't appreciate that either.
Yeah, so that is why, I think there is a series actually that has kind of snuck. I think part of it is my inability to let the show go, for sure. But you know what? I mean, there are good sequels, so. Maybe
you heard it here.
At the very least, we'll do some webisodes.
I mean,
I know Emily's down. I know Todd's down. That's about it.
No, that's peer pressure, Amanda, right there.
Yeah.
I wasn't invited. I can be the boom operator.
We definitely need to hear from the world's leading virologist, I think, at this time. before we let you guys go, tell us where we can see you next or hear your words next.
Emily.
You go.
Okay. Schitt's Creek is a show that's on the air now until we're doing our final season. And so there's that coming up. The end is coming. And I'm about to go shoot this new Stephen King series, which I'm very excited about.
Is that a limited run or is that a...
Yes.
I posted about it.
It's 10 episodes.
That's so exciting. Emily, that's so exciting.
Yeah. I'm really like the... It's set in 1850 and I get to wear a corset and be a...
Where are you shooting that?
Nova Scotia.
Ooh, Burr. Have fun. That's really great.
Emily, yeah. can we hear a little bit of your Victorian experience? I'm really eager to hear what you're going to do. What does it sound like? Tell us, please.
I believe you have a voice note of that. So there you go. You I sent you a
voice note. I want to hear. Do it.
No, Terry. I'm not prepared. You have to tune in to see that.
So that's a long
time. Watch a little Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins and you got it.
Yeah. That's, oh my God, you're so right, Amanda. Amanda, I know where people can see you next.
Yeah, do you want to share that for me on my behalf?
No, you go ahead.
Okay. This Friday, March 13th, I am in an episode of MacGyver. Thank you to Terry Metalis. I had a really fun time. So that's the very next time I will be invading people's screens.
I said Henry Ian Cusick.
Yeah, he goes by Ian. Do you call him Henry Ian?
Ian. Well, but the folks at home know him as
Henry Ian.
Yeah. Desmond from Lost.
Yeah. Yeah, we just call him Desmond.
And do you know that he, after shooting Lost, he stayed in Hawaii. He lived there. So his commute to Atlanta for work was a challenge. I'm from Hawaii also. So that was really exciting to work with him and find that common ground. He's a lovely man.
And Amanda gets to play a doctor again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about you, Sean?
We just started season 3 of Mayans MC, which I'm an EP on. So very excited to do that. Hopefully we can do that before there's any sort of strike. I get to direct this year, which is cool, which will be fun. That'll be out in September.
When do you start your directing? Which episode?
Episode 7. So right now we're just in a mad dash to get script done so that
finish it all out.
But we're close. We're working on that one this week. So
congratulations, Sean. That's great.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And Terry, how's Picard going?
It's good, and it's ironically our neighbor is Sean Tretta. We're at the same
studio. We work across the street from each other now.
We literally walk across the street from each other. Where and then on Picard is, you know, I'm working with Chris Moffett and Travis Fickett. So it's there's a lot of monkeys right there in Santa Clarita.
Mm-hmm.
It's going great. We start shooting June 15th, and it is not what you think. Let's put it that way. It's an interesting.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I'm excited.
When I think back to what I love about Diglaca, and I think about sort of the epic montage with you and Emily, but then you restart the episode and it's this incredibly tense, like you feel the tension with people being lined up and shot. It couldn't be any higher stakes that are truly terrifying.
But that was the line that 12 Monkeys walk. Maybe not the first couple of episodes. Once we got our groove, that was a line that the writers and, you know, Terry developed, and the producers, everybody understood that it was a really interesting, unique entity all unto its own, that, you know, we would have these moments of very tense, high stakes, and then Jennifer Goins would say something completely absurd to let the air out of it a little bit, just so that you could ramp it back up again, because you can't have 42 minutes of just that sort of drama. People will fatigue, I think. And I think that they did a really good job of understanding that.
Because some shows, especially over the past couple of years, have done that. Mm-hmm. And I know at least for Tina and I, like at the end of all that, we hated it. I mean,
yeah, it's tiring, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, particularly when the world is going to hell, it's not, you need a little bit of balance. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You want to be able to relate to things, and hopefully nobody's day is completely full of angst and drama and, you know, exhaustion. Every once in a while, you have to have a laugh about something, or at least find a humor in something. That's what makes humanity humanity.
Yeah. I think those are the times that people need to laugh the most.
Yeah, exactly.
To be able to keep going.
Yeah.
It's also just not realistic. I mean, we've been sitting here cracking pandemic jokes, even though it's obviously something that's very serious, but there's just, how else do you cope, right? When the news is not great. Yeah. Thank you guys so much for being so generous with your time this morning. And surprise guest, I mean, man, having Emily and Amanda on along with two of the writers that wrote one of basically everyone who listens' favorite episodes of TV is just really special. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you for letting me crash, guys.
Anytime. You just let us know. We will talk to you anytime.
Bye. Let's do this again, friends.
And there you have it. Just want to say a huge thank you again to Emily, Amanda, Terry, and Sean for spending your Sunday morning with us right after you had already lost an hour from the time jumping forward. It's all very confusing. It seems like that was actually appropriate for this conversation. Our next episode will be 407 Daughters, and Chris Moffett will be back as the writer to break that one down. Until next time, we'll see you soon.